I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, the theme is Question Authority, with not one, but two guests. First up, a pertinent conversation with investigative reporter Arun Gupta, whose most recent work has been organizing the No More Concentration Camps movement, which is doing admirable work protesting ICE, federal detention centers, and the abhorrent treatment of immigrants and refugees along the U.S. border. Then, returning guest, Joseph E. Green, a contributing writer for Garrison, the Journal of History and Deep Politics, joins us to discuss the life and times of satirist, activist, and all-around counterculture icon Paul Krasner, who passed away in late July at the age of 87, leaving behind a legacy that will not be forgotten. But first, my conversation with the aforementioned Arun Gupta of the No More Concentration Camps movement. The firecracker congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez caused more than a bit of a stir this summer when she referred to ICE detention centers as concentration camps. Some pundits have argued that categorizing these detention centers as such is a bridge too far and ultimately irresponsible. Arun Gupta, however, argues that they are dead wrong. Now, why don't we let Arun explain why? Welcome to Parallax Views, Arun Gupta of No More Concentration Camps, a new movement that I'm very excited about.
Hey, JG. Great to be with you today.
Well, I wanted to have you on because this new movement, I'm very excited about it. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about the No More Concentration Camps movement and just give an overview of it, maybe.
Well, There is a movement, no more concentration camps, because now we have concentration camps in America. It's not, I think, a state that many of us wanted to be in. But I think this really started to take off in June when Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said that we now have concentration camps, and explained that, these meet the historical definition of concentration camps. It's actually a very simple definition, which is that are you concentrating a group of people, imprisoning them based on their solely on their identity? And that is exactly what's going on. And so I've been an investigative reporter for many years. I write on a lot of different subjects, some of which include immigration, refugees, policing. I've been down on both sides of the border to do reporting. And this it's hit me very personally, in part because of my reporting, in part also because I'm an immigrant as well. That, it's just like, that was kind of, I think it woke up a lot of people. And I was just like, shit, that's right. These are concentration camps. And I think for a lot of people, that was like really a holy shit moment. It's just like, there are now concentration camps in the United States of America. And we know that we've had generally a horrendous immigration policy from both parties, going back especially to the Clinton administration, which created the legal architecture for much of the repression and criminalization of immigration. Then after 9/11, where you start to get the massive increase in policing, surveillance, militarization of the border, the whole right wing kind of demonization of immigrants,
and the birth of ICE under Bush.
Exactly. And this is a whole thing about abolish ICE. It's just like, this is they are the deportation police, right? And they serve a similar function to that of the Gestapo under Nazi Germany. Their job is to identify foreigners, undesirable groups, and remove them from the country. And as I mentioned, I've been on both sides of the border. And when you deport people, it is a death sentence, essentially. A lot of the people, they tend to be men most of whom get deported, because it's men coming over. And in Tijuana, they're just thousands of deportees who are living on the streets. There's a lot of complex reasons that go into that. But if they don't get off the streets in the first couple of weeks, going back to their hometown or village, they wind up on the streets, and they're going to die on the streets. And even if you do go to, where you came from, I've lived in Mexico before, and on the Pacific coast. And I would often meet people who, lived in the U.S. and were deported. And, it's just like, your life expectancy is going to go down. You have a worse indices in terms of like access to health care, housing, just the public health and all that. So ICE, which is born after September 11th, it's just like, this is not something that we need or should have. So this is bipartisan policy. Then we see with Obama, he continues the architecture of the immigration repression. And the rationale was like, if he shows that he's tough on immigration, the Republicans will come to a deal, come to the table. It's just like, the naivete there is just breathtaking, right? He's supposed to be such a savvy politician. And, then what we see under Obama is they do start to ramp down, decrease the deportations. And we also see, the development of the Dreamers movement. These are people, young people who came over as children And there's been a lot of agitation around them because it's basically, this is the only country they know. And it's just like, that's me. I came over when I was about 5 years old, and this is the only country that I know. You know, it's just like, if I'm forced to go back to India, it's just like, this is not, you know, a country I know. I don't know the language. I've met people in Mexico who were dumped there. And, you know, I don't know if they even survived. I didn't know Spanish, and they're like dumped in Tijuana with like literally a couple of dollars in their pocket, and, you know, no way to call someone. They don't have any family in Mexico because their family's all in the U.S. So, you know, it's really horrifying what we're doing. But with Trump, you know, I think we have to understand the architecture, right, and the Democratic complicity. But at the same time, I think there's this kind of leftist attitude, like it's all the same, which is just utter BS. With Trump, what we are seeing is white nationalism. It is ethnic cleansing. You know, I actually wrote about this during the 2016 campaign. I covered his campaign. And days before the election, I wrote a piece that Trump's plan to make America great again is ethnic cleansing.
And so many other journalists, I think, were afraid to go that far and just call a spade in that case.
Yeah, I mean, the reporting was just incredible. Absolutely terrible. Like, people were not willing to see what was going on. And, you know, I'll just, so this recent debate, is Trump racist or not? And, you know, it's just like, you have the media patting themselves on the back for like saying like Trump is a racist when he told the four congresswomen to go back to where they came from, you know, to go back to their countries, you know. And so the thing with that is just like, did you really need over 4 years to figure this out? When he came down that elevator, you know, the gold elevator in Trump Towers, his whole campaign began as this like white nationalist, like bullhorn, you know, saying Mexicans are rapists, drug dealers, and criminals. They're not sending their best. You know, it was, he ran on a racist platform. And before that, of course, was birtherism. You know, then we have the Muslim ban, then, you know, the thing with the judge, you know, even the U.S. born judge is like, he can't be trusted because he's Mexican, even though he was born in the U.S. You know, neo-Nazis are very fine people. You know, it's just like, the guy is a white nationalist. And what we're seeing is a deliberate policy of cruelty in these camps. And so we're just one of many different efforts. I want to be clear that, first of all, there's the groups that have been doing this incredibly important and extremely difficult work for years and decades. A lot of Latinx, brown and black immigrant organizations, especially in border areas, groups like United We Dream, Movimiento Cosecha, American Friends Service Committee has been doing a lot of great work on this. So what we're trying to do is amplify this work. And then there are new organizations that are forming. You know, we have ours right now. We're digital, but we're building the capacity to start calling for actions. That's why, you know, folks should check nomorecamps.org regularly to see, because we have an updated events calendar on there, and also check the Facebook page, No More Concentration Camps. There's another group called Close the Concentration Camps that we're working with. They're calling for national actions in mid-October. Because if we don't shut down these concentration camps, they're only going to get worse. You know, that's what history tells us. You know, there was a book that just came out by this woman, Andrea Pritzker, I believe, called One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps. And so, you know, it's just like, here's the leading expert. And she's like, yes, these are concentration camps on the border. And she wrote a good piece in the New York Review of Books. And one of the important things she pointed out is like, look, you know, the Nazi concentration camps did not start out as concentration camps. And additionally, you know, the Nazis come to power in 1933. It's 5 years before you see Kristallnacht, right? What we have just seen in El Paso, Mexico, that is a pogrom. You know, that meets the definition of it, where it is this kind of this violent racial terror. And it's and the shooter, I looked at his, I read his manifesto thoroughly. His words come straight from Trump's mouth.
He literally says in the opening of that manifesto that he's doing the attack because of what he calls the Hispanic invasion of Texas.
Yeah. And Trump is constantly talking about invasion. And, you know, this is the whole thing. Like last fall in October of 2018, we saw Robert Bowers, the anti-Semite neo-Nazi who shot up the Tree of Life synagogue, killing, I believe, 11 people.
That happened here in Pittsburgh. It hit me very hard.
Yeah. And so, you know, he was using Trump's rhetoric. Then we have the MAGA bomber, Cesar Sayoc. And I've actually at the Raw Story, which I write regularly for, and I'm writing a piece about this that'll be published soon about the El Paso shooter, Patrick Cruzes, that his manifesto came straight from Trump's mouth. You know, just like he may have pulled the trigger, but, you know, it was Trump who filled his magazine with the hate and violence and provided him with the targets. You know, we had the MAGA bomber who was going after, you know, the Trump superfan who was going after Trump's targets, even as he was naming them. But there's a dozen other cases, right? You know, this guy is the scum of the earth, Donald Trump. You know, I'm from New York, and it's just like Trump has always been a joke, a con man. And it's pathetic how all these losers have fallen for, you know, this just really just a vile con man, because he doesn't care about them. He's laughing all the way to the bank, you know.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I always hear Trump referred to as a populist, and I don't think he cares about the populace, though. I don't think he cares about the masses at all. He's just your, you know, he's your typical strong man that just wants to keep accumulating power.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I should even say, like, for him, it's not, I think, even about the money anymore. It's just like, because he's, as we know, a failed businessman. He got $500 million from daddy. And if he had just put that in an S&P index fund, he'd be worth more money, than he is now. It's just really about his ego. He just wants to be worshipped. But he represents, you know, really in every single way, the worst of America. And, you know, what we're seeing is, I think at this point, so what I was saying earlier about how, like, the media, like, they pat themselves on the back for saying, like, he's racist. It's just like, first of all, this is neoliberal crap, right? It's just like, racism is not about an individual. It's not about, like, oh, how's Donald Trump going to treat that, like, black person or that Latino person? Racism is about a structure and a system. And the mainstream media are just really terrible and incapable of understanding and reporting out the structures of racism.
I wanted to comment on that real quick. I was listening to an interview of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez where I think it was Michael Isikoff was saying, but is Trump really racist in his heart? Are you saying Trump is racist in his heart? And AOC basically just said, you know, that's not the issue. Racism is structural. I just wish we could get that across to people more.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, I think at this point what we see is that neoliberal liberal just means neoliberal. The two have essentially been collapsed, right? It's all about individual responsibility. It's basically, you know, they've become Thatcherites. There is no society. They're just as individuals. They have no understanding of social structures of history. Like, you know, I put up a test on my Facebook page, you know, and asking people, like, how many pogroms can you name from the early 20th century? Right. And it's just like, if you say that to people, they're like, what are you talking about? Right. You know, it's just like, well, we're talking about Black Wall Street, the destruction of Tulsa, the slaughter of 300 black people, Rosewood, Florida, Elaine, Arkansas, the Red Summer, Chicago of 1919, Chicago, Memphis, East St. Louis, all these cities, like scores, if not hundreds of African Americans were slaughtered. And the usual way, like, you know, if you even learn about it in school, it's briefly touched on, and it's called a race riot, right? So it's like basically blame is spread evenly. And none of this is taught, you know, these also are not just about like killing, they're also about dispossession. You know, like another question I ask people is just like, do you know what a sundown town is, right? You know, it's just like, and it's just like, I'm sure you have a very informed audience, but I bet you that the majority of them don't know what sundown towns are. You know, and these are towns in which it was apocryphal. It may have actually been true that, you know, there were signs at the edge of town that said, you know, N blank, N word, don't let yourself be caught in this town after sundown. And there's a historian who wrote a book on it, James Lowen, and has documented this. And he said when he began, he expected to find like a couple of dozen sundown towns across the country. And they've now identified over 3,000. And it turns out that this is the origin of the suburbs. That, you know, why is it that, you know, these suburbs are lily white? It just didn't happen this way because there was ethnic cleansing. And I came across another recent project where their historians putting together an ethnic cleansing map. And what is going on is dispossession. And the thing is, we see the same thing actually with immigration policy. I did a piece a few years ago for The Nation about what's called the prison debit card industry. And what that involves is in jails mainly, 90% of arrestees go through jails, right? That's at the county level. They're run by sheriffs. This is a whole other story, that sheriffs are the most powerful local officials in the country, and they are just so corrupt, so many of them. And so in the majority of jails now, suppose you go in and you have $100, right? You're innocent, right? You know, it's just like, that's just like pretrial stuff, and you're released. Well, you don't get your money back. You get a debit card back. And those debit cards come with all sorts of fees that are hard to avoid. And it's a way to take money, people's own money. It turns out it's undocumented immigrants who get hit the worst by this, because what happens when they get picked up, first of all, they don't have access to banking services. So a lot of them, I talked to this one guy who had $2,100 on him because he just came from a job and had all this money for him and a couple of the workers. The sheriffs take his money. They give him back a debit card. He's dumped into Mexico. Often the cards don't work in Mexico. And then if you need help, you have to call a 1-800 number, which doesn't work for Mexico. And he was eventually able to get in touch with this group, No Más Muertes, No More Deaths, who's being like, this group is also being repressed by the Trump administration. They're being prosecuted, for like, leaving water in the desert, you know, where thousands of people have died, over the last 20 years. They're being prosecuting for harboring fugitives. So in any case, he was able to recover his money. But when I was reporting out this story, what I found is like, what do you think happens when, you know, the interior removals? This is what Obama was so bad on. You know, it's one thing if you cross the border, right, and you're caught and you're deported. These are like human rights workers were telling me this. Immigrant advocates were telling me this. It's just like, you're just going to try again, like in a few days, in a couple weeks, right? You're going to try and go across the border again. But the interior removals are people who have set down roots here, who've been here 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. Some of them have been here 40 years. And they have family, they have homes, they have businesses, they have cars. What do you think happens to all that? It's basically taken. So this is a form of dispossession, right? And this is what this country is formed on. The primitive capital accumulation is it's Native American genocide is intimately linked to the primitive primitive capital accumulation to taking over the land, taking over the resources, right? And then, of course, we also have chattel slavery. But what we're seeing is continually also from these pogroms, you know, that are in the post-Civil War era through the early first few decades of the 20th century. It wasn't that just that blacks would be killed or, you know, they were run out of town. And who do you think is taking over their property? You know, it's just like the most vicious type of dispossession you can imagine. And this is the story of America. And so I don't want to compare what's going on now. As bad as it is, obviously, it's not like the genocide of Native Americans. It's not like, you know, slavery, but it's pretty bad. The fact that we're now starting to see pogroms again, what we essentially are at the beginning stages of fascism. We have concentration camps. We have pogroms. We have an authoritarian demagogue who wants to bring it into being an ethnic state an ethno state. It's based on national birth and national renewal. These are like conditions of fascism against degeneracy and using ethnic cleansing. And then, you know, there's all the gender stuff as well, right? You know, that's a very important component on this. Remember, because they're constantly going after stuff like anchor babies. They, you know, they talk about like, you know, use terms like infestation, right? You know, to like dehumanize these people. And then we also see this extreme, you know, policies around reproductive rights, where, you know, the right wing essentially wants to make sexual slaves out of women. And it's also coupled with this, then we see this kidnapping of children. You know, thousands of children were kidnapped last year. A judge eventually said this is unconstitutional because family integrity is what's called an unenumerated constitutional right under the Ninth Amendment. And they were ordered to stop separating families. And there've been at least 900 separations since last year. And we also learned last week, a week or two ago, of this policy where if a parent is HIV positive, they're separating them from the child, even though this is based on, you know, this kind of like 1980s bigotry, right? That if you're HIV positive, that you're somehow contagious to everyone around you. So, you know, instead of like, you know, so the media, this is, you know, I know a long arc, but the media wants to pat itself on the back about like, oh, Trump is a racist. This was evident in June of 2015. The debate we should be having now is like, is a fascist state and society coming into being? And, you know, I think, you know, we can debate this. My answer is yes. Hell yeah. This is what we're seeing. You know, we have brown shirts in the street. We have, you know, ethnic extrajudicial violence that matches the state violence.
I was going to say we have these groups like the Oath Keepers. You know, intimidating people with their guns. You know, I mean, this is pretty bad.
Yeah, and the Oath Keepers aren't even the worst by any means. Like, because I've actually talked to a bunch of Oath Keepers. It's more like the Proud Boys, the Patriot Prayer, all the like various the alphabet soup of neo-Nazi movements that have grown up. You know, like there's the Rise Above movement, which are like violent, extreme neo-Nazis. I've been tracking like these white supremacist murders. That's a whole thing. Like, you know, you find all these like little Nazis, and that's what they are. Like these the diehard Trump supporters are no different than the Germans who supported the Nazi Party. And without going into too much detail, I'll just say I know this because unfortunately, I do have some extended family relations to German Nazis, like people who were in the Hitler Youth and who still admire Adolf Hitler, and you know, they're regular people. You know, it's just like they have a job, they care about their family. You know, they can even like marry into, you know, a brown family, but they're still Nazis. And, you know, this is a thing that we're seeing in the U.S. as well, that, you know, when you see people who are legitimizing concentration camps, who are saying like, oh, well, it's the parents' fault, they shouldn't come here illegally. You know, I'll say one thing quickly about that. Like, If you, like, especially for your listeners, anyone ever says to you, well, they should come here legally, you know, legal is legal. There's two ways that you should hit back and hit back hard. It's, first of all, slavery was legal. Genocide was legal. Jim Crow was legal. Women, second class status was legal. Child labor was legal. The worst stuff in human history has been legal. You don't think the Holocaust was legal? But secondly, you want to talk about illegal. Everything the Trump administration is doing is criminal. Preventing people from applying for asylum violates U.S. laws. Sending asylum seekers back to Mexico violates U.S. laws. Holding people for longer than 72 hours is a violation of U.S. policy. Holding children longer than 20 days, and the average length is now 72 days, is a violation of U.S. law.
And I'm assuming the conditions themselves are bad.
That violates that's what I was just getting to. That violates the Flores Agreement, right? And need it be said, collective punishment and torture, especially of children, is illegal, right? So whenever anyone says to you, oh, they should be legal, it's just like the real criminals are the Trump administration. Everything they're doing is illegal. You support criminals, right? You are racist Nazi scum. You are just looking for any excuse to support white nationalism. You know, these people are losers and they need to be hounded. You know, I'm of the opinion now, like, you know, everyone knows some of these people and just hound them as the racist scum that they are. Like if you're related to them, you know, and they come over for the holidays, just like the whole time, just go after them and humiliate them in front of your family, because that's what needs to happen to them. You know, they should not be allowed. If they want to go live with the other Nazi scum, they can. These are, you know, worthless people, in my opinion.
Well, I know you have to get going, but there's just one thing I wanted to cover briefly was the actual conditions. I understand there's a lot of children going malnourished, not getting soap and toothbrushes and whatnot. And also, I wanted you to maybe comment real briefly on how there's a lot of Jewish organizers getting involved with the movement now.
Yeah, and you know, this is a thing, like, you know, it's just like there's all just these asinine hand-wringing liberals. It's just like, oh, but they're not really concentration camps. And actually, it's just like, you know, when we began this call, we had like a dozen rabbis sign on who are just like, and there's hundreds of rabbis who've been like, these are concentration camps, okay? And it's just like, there is no debate. I had an exchange with an NPR reporter who was trying to act like this is a controversial question. It's just like, there is no controversy here. There is a clear definition. And it's just like, the mainstream media are just so terrible. But, you know, what you're talking about, the conditions, it's just like, yes, it's, they're unsanitary. They're unsafe. There's a disease. And what we saw, I think, this case recently is very telling. This, a young man who's a U.S. citizen born in the U.S. was picked up and held for over 3 weeks in an ICE facility, and they wouldn't let him go. And this is the whole thing we have to remember, just the criminality, of these ICE agents. So that's another thing. Like, basically, all their raids are illegal. They're unconstitutional because they don't have judicial warrants. They have administrative warrants, and that does not allow you to enter someone's home. That does not allow you to take someone from a vehicle, to search their vehicle, to stop them. And yet they do this all the time. So all these like people who are like, we have to respect the Constitution, you know, it's just like they don't give a shit about the Constitution because ICE is constantly violating it. The Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizure. But the thing about these camps, what we learned from this young man who was picked up, he lost, I think, in 3 weeks. It was shocking. It was like he was already thin to begin with, and he lost like 16 pounds. You know, it's just like that's basically a starvation diet. Maybe it was 13 pounds, but nonetheless, that's a deficit of about 1800 calories a day. He was, you know, saying that there was, you know, he didn't shower the whole time. There was like all these sick people in there. When we have these tours of the facility, you know, these reports come out that the government officials are all wearing like surgical masks, you know, because there's so much disease. And this is the thing, you know, Andrea Pritzker, when she wrote this piece in the New York Review of Books, she point out, like, look, Ravensbrück, which became, which was the female concentration camp that turned into a death camp, she cited one of the early inmates in there who was writing about how they were getting clean linen, they were being served fresh fruit, sausages, jam, they were getting silverware. It was a concentration camp, and it's just like, these things don't start out like this, right? You know, it's just like the death. It's nearly a decade from when the Nazis come to power to the Wannsee Conference, and I think that was 1942, where they come up with the final solution, right? So it took, you know, nearly a decade for them to get there. And the thing is, it's just like, it's not hard to imagine these concentration camps becoming death camps, given, you know, in 20, 30 years, given the trajectories of catastrophic climate change, of social, increasing social chaos that we see, just the, you know, the capitalist led, you know, just raping of these countries for their resources, that you can see more and more migrant flows, and we end up like outsourcing these concentration camps to Mexico. And of course the elites don't care, you know, they don't, you know, and I think, you know, one other point that's worth mentioning is, like, look at the pictures of who is being locked up, right? And what do you see when you see pictures of the people in these concentration camps in Texas?
I mean, I see a lot of just the children in cages were really hard to just bear.
They're all indigenous faces, though.
Right.
And so we are doing the same shit we've been doing for over 500 years. We are still exterminating indigenous people. Right. And the elites in Mexico and Central America hate indigenous people. Most of them. And so, you know, they don't care. They would be happy to be the gendarmes for U.S. American death camps if they were handsomely rewarded. So, you know, this is some very ugly trends that we're seeing. And we're not there yet, but we don't want to be like, you know, to the point of where, like, well, only 2 million have been killed, so they're not really like death camps. You know, it's just like, we need to end this now. So, you know, I encourage everyone, you know, go to nomorecamps.org. Go to our Facebook page, No More Concentration Camps. If you can chip in $5, we can really use your support. And, you know, get out on the streets, get active. You know, we're going to have resources on how to organize, everything from holding a meeting to how to hold a protest. There's lots of stuff going on. We need to amp up the pressure, especially going into 2020. It's just like, you know, even the best intentioned Democratic candidates, we can't depend on them.
Well, I was gonna add real quickly in that regard, the people who say, well, if we just vote blue in 2020, this will all end. I don't think that's necessarily completely true. I think that we have to worry about how the actions ICE are taking now can become institutionally normalized. Because once they're normalized, I mean, that becomes an even bigger problem.
Yeah, and that's not how social change works. You know, that's just a fundamental reality. So, you know, social change, you need to have all sorts of different forces. Now, you can institutionalize a change through the legislative electoral process, but you need the independent forces to start to start to create that change. And just one example, you know, we have numerous examples, right? Black Lives Matter, or the climate justice movement. One of the biggest examples is Occupy Wall Street. Before Occupy Wall Street, all the talk was about economic austerity. After Occupy Wall Street, it becomes about income inequality. We start to see the movement of the $15 an hour minimum wage movement. And now we see, like, you know, basically the Democratic Party is Bernie Sanders' party, you know, there. And it's just like we're talking about all these redistributive policies. We have an actual socialist who could very well, you know, at least in name, who could very well win the nomination. You know, what he really proposes is kind of like modest social welfare state. You know, they're critics who are like, you know, if Bernie Sanders was in Europe, he'd actually be kind of center right. You know, that shows you like how kind of far to the right the American system is. But in any case, it's the independent movements that create social change. And if you need any more evidence, look at what's going on in Puerto Rico. Look at what's going on in Hong Kong, right? We need millions of people in the streets shutting shit down. That's how we stop this.
Well, hey, Arun Gupta of the No More Concentration Camps movement, I really want to thank you. You stayed an extra few minutes to hash things out some more. I really appreciate it. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, listeners. I hope you found my conversation with Arun Gupta uplifting in as much as it reminds us that there are many organizing for justice in our world. I highly recommend looking into nomorecamps.org if you are interested in getting more information on the movement. And now we turn from the activism of the present to the activism of the past, as we remember the life and times of satirist, activist, and counterculture icon Paul Krasner. Alongside Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, Paul Krasner founded the Youth International Party, or the Yippies, a band of merry pranksters with sharp minds and critical wits. The Yippies challenged right-wing authoritarians in the era of Vietnam. As one of the last true icons of not only the Youth International Party, but the 60s counterculture as a whole, Paul Krasner's passing at the age of 87 on July 21st, 2019, is particularly melancholic. However, with our next guest, Joseph E. Green, we hope to celebrate the life, times, and legacy of this legendary rebel. And now, on to my conversation with Joseph E. Green, remembering the great Paul Krasner. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Joseph Green.
How you doing?
Pretty good, Joseph. Last time we had you on, it was one of the early episodes. We talked about the peace activist, and some would say conspiracy theorist, although I don't like that term. It's too pejorative. John Judge, though, we were talking about. On yes. This episode, we're going to be remembering another pretty pivotal counterculture figure, Paul Krasner, who's been described as an investigative satirist. He passed away on July 21st, 2019, at 87 years old. For my listeners that may not be familiar with Paul Krasner, although he has been getting some media attention, his passing, there was just an article on him on his passing, an obituary on him in Teen Vogue. So we have young people learning about him now. But for those who may not be familiar with Paul Krasner, who was this man?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to he had a very active life. He was involved in all kinds of stuff, and he's hard to summarize. So, but I guess the way to start with it, I mean, at least where I kind of start with it, is with the publication of a magazine called The Realist. And Paul Krasner was in the counterculture before there was a counterculture.
Can I slide in for just a second?
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's sort of, The Realist was sort of like one of the first underground press, yes, publications, sort of like what Adam Parfrey's Feral House or Richard Metzger's Disinfo would become. There were other, I guess, precursors like I.F. Stone's Weekly and The Village Voice, but The Realist was a different beast altogether in a lot of ways.
Yes. I mean, I.F. Stone's Weekly and The Village Voice were still basically, especially in the case of Stone, pretty respectable, you know, vaguely left of center, but not what we would call radical. There's no radical politics in those. I mean, maybe Stone a little bit for the time, although we'd find out exactly how radical he was when Kennedy got killed. But The Realist was a different thing. It was more like it's really the template. You're absolutely right about Adam Parfrey and Metzger. And now I guess you would compare it to what the kind of shows like, I don't even know the names of them, but the sort of comedy slash political shows that they have on television, Stephen Colbert and that sort of thing. That's what it became.
Well, I mean, even I mentioned Teen Vogue. It's weird because Teen Vogue is like publishing articles on, you know, anarchism. That's for like, yeah, a 15 to 25 demographic. So even they have a little bit in common with The Realist.
No, they do. And actually, the person who brought my attention to Teen Vogue was my wife, because she was saying, you know, because she's a trauma therapist. And I think it was about a year ago or so, she showed me this article and she said, you know, this is actually a really good article about, you know, sexual trauma. Like, it's not a stupid article. It's pretty sensible, and Teen Vogue seems to be onto something here. So that's really cool that they're doing that. I'm all more power to them. And in fact, they're at this point, they're probably better than anything you can get on television, because although I made the comparison to Stephen Colbert, I should specify that that's a very debased version of what was going on in The Realist. The Realist was kind of like Mad Magazine, I guess, but much more scatological and much more line crossing. And it had these, the sort of the classic one was the pages left out of the Kennedy book, which I'm sure all of the obituaries of Krasner are talking about. So after Kennedy's assassination, JFK's wife gave a long conversation to William Manchester, who was writing the sort of official book of the day. And there was stuff that she didn't want published, and Krasner tried to get that material. And when he was not able to get that material, he made up a story about Lyndon Johnson putting his penis in Kennedy's neck wound. And there was two striking things that happened. One is that a lot of people believed the story. They thought it was true, including people like Daniel Ellsberg.
Of the Pentagon Papers fame.
Yes, yes. So Ellsberg told, you know, Krasner, I think I wished it was true. But then also, of course, people were completely outraged, because that's a really horrible image, and it is a really horrible image, and it's in bad taste, and it's all of those things. And Krasner said, yeah, that, in other words, that if we're really talking about free speech, if we're talking about publishing various points of view, then we are going to have to go into the area of bad taste. And that's what really distinguishes The Realist from something like I.F. Stone's Weekly or The Village Voice, He was not afraid to publish something that he thought was either funny or had a real point to it. When the shootings happened in relation to the cartoon in France.
Oh, Charlie Hebdo.
The Charlie Hebdo. Krasner sent me his article that he had done for I think it was for Counterpunch. I can't remember, but he sent me the article, and it had an image on it that had all of these Muslim folks holding signs that said, "I am Charles Manson," which is a pretty, again, it's in really, really bad taste. But that's Krasner. And he was like, you know, 80 something years old when he did that. So more power to him.
Well, you know, let's lay some groundwork. The Realist, I guess, starts in, I believe, 1958. It starts gaining more and more of an audience throughout the 60s. And then it becomes sort of irregular after the early 1970s. But maybe we can lay the groundwork for, like, what was going on in the culture politically and socially at the time Paul Krasner started The Realist.
Yeah, so it sort of begins with Lenny Bruce. And Lenny Bruce was a good friend of Krasner. And they were both pushing boundaries at the same time, like I say, in the 50s, before all of this stuff happened. And then when you started to have the major assassinations of the 60s and Vietnam happened, and there was this whole cultural movement that happened, Krasner's right in the middle of it. So if you're telling the story of the 60s, he's a big part of it because he's hanging around with all these guys. And what I mean is like, so the big thing was that in 1964, there was a very famous, let's call it a bus ride, the Merry Pranksters of Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey had written the novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which people may know. And that whole thing, that whole trip, which was taken in a bus, where these folks were driving through the desert handing out LSD to people, was written up by Tom Wolfe in his most famous book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Now, the folks that were on the bus were radicals and people that maybe you don't know as much now, but included folks like Neil Cassidy. Neil Cassidy was very important to the beat writers. He was, I don't know, in some ways, I guess, Kerouac's muse. I don't know however you would consider that relationship. Neil Cassidy was really important to Ginsberg and Kerouac.
Cassidy was the one that, not to interrupt you, Cassidy was the one that wanted to do, like, he would take meth because he wanted to, like, speed up his brain to make it that it was, like right on, like, time with, I forget how he described it. It was something very weird.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and that's what the period was. It was an experimental period. It was, you know, we're gonna do that. We're gonna take drugs. Krasner knew Timothy Leary. Was friends with Timothy Leary. You can find an interview that Krasner did with Tim Leary, like in the mid '90s, and you can find that on YouTube if you want to check that out. Very interesting. Hunter S. Thompson, of course. Was in the middle of all this, and he wrote about the fact that Paul Krasner was apparently the guy who introduced the Hell's Angels to LSD, which is just cool. And Hunter Thompson wrote that in his book about the Hell's Angels, like in 65 or 66, I think. Allen Ginsberg wrote a famous poem about the bus tour with Ken Kesey and the Hell's Angels and the parties that they used to have. So definitely in the middle of the whole drug movement that was going on in the 60s and the movement toward opening your mind, you know, the opening the doors of perception, that was the attitude that they had in those days. And then the other I guess big thing that Krasner was involved in that whole period was the Yippies, which the Youth International Party. It's founded in 1967. Krasner used to call them the Groucho Marxists. And they did, I guess it would be the precursor to the kinds of activities that are done now, like flash mobs, I guess would be the closest comparison, because what they did was kind of aesthetic stunts that were designed to pull attention to them, which then they would use politically. The most famous one being that the Yippies said that they were going to levitate the Pentagon. And the United States is essentially a giant bureaucracy, and this is so indicative of what our country is like. So the Yippies had meetings with people in Washington, D.C., and they determined that should their levitation succeed, they would not be able to raise the Pentagon more than 22 feet because that was the length of the ladder. And so that would be disallowed. And, you know, John Judge used to tell me that when they would try to have protests in D.C., you would end up having meetings with six or seven different organizations because there are so many different groups, you know, not just it's like the police, the park police, the police for this, the police for that, the security for this. And you got to talk to all of them. And that's exactly what they experienced even in the 60s. They're talking to these bureaucrats who are telling them how far they can raise the Pentagon should it work. That was the kind of stuff they did. Sometimes concerts, although those tended not to go very well.
They once threw money off the New York Stock Exchange.
Yes, they threw money. they went to the New York Stock Exchange with dollar bills and they threw them down. And Krasner said that those guys had been involved in such an abstraction that when they saw the actual dollars, they ran for them and grabbed them. And it was hilarious to actually watch them do this. You know, it's like the ending of The Magic Christian, if you're familiar with that book or the film they did where they put a bunch of money in a tub of excrement and people jump in to get it, which is so true, unfortunately. It's hard. It really is hard to sum up everything you do. And there's another cool thing about the Yippies, which is that they closed down Disneyland in 1970. They invaded it and invaded with like 100 people. And Disneyland actually closed down because of the antics of the Yippies. And they had only closed down one other time, which was, of course, for the assassination of President Kennedy. And I think that when you're looking at everything that they were doing, I feel like they did inspire a lot of the stuff that goes on in different ways. I mean, the way that especially depending on what part of the internet you're on, the desire to shock. But in their case, the desire to shock was armed with a political point.
Well, it's like the Trump, the giant Trump baby balloon that they had flying in Britain. You know, that's sort of like what they did with the levitate the Pentagon, which they knew they weren't going to levitate the Pentagon, right? They were just trying to bring attention to an anti-war protest. So they did these little pranks that would draw attention to real issues.
Yes, absolutely. And so because of this, they did get a lot of attention. And one thing that I found out, I didn't know this, but at one point, the Realist magazine had a circulation of about 100,000, which is pretty incredible for a sometimes fairly filthy leftist political magazine. And in general, what I would say is God bless Paul Krasner, because he was a really good writer too. And that's actually how, we got in contact. I guess I can talk about this for a minute if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I had written, speaking of Adam Parfrey, Feral House put out a collection of the collected works of Mae Brussel. And Alex Constantine had edited that book, and Krasner did the introduction. And so when that came out, also a friend of mine, John Potash, had just come out with a book called Drugs as Weapons Against Us. And I thought that there were certain similarities between
what Potash argued and what Russell argued, and I did a combination review of both books. And so Alex put that on the Constantine Report, and my friend Dave Ratcliffe also has it on Radical. And somehow Krasner saw it, and so he wrote me a nice note about it, and we talked about May, because one of the things that happened with May Brussel is that she got trivialized as the quote unquote conspiracy queen. And it was a way of diminishing her, the fact that she was a housewife and she didn't have the sort of formal background that one would expect from a scholar of May's level, because she was a genius. It was, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, which is unfortunate, because think what you will of May, what the mainstream thinks of May's work, but she was calling things like Watergate prior to really anyone having their nose to the ground on it and sort of sniffing for clues. She was calling things a lot earlier a lot of times.
Brussel basically solved Watergate instantly in real time. And Paul Krasner published that article in The Realist. And he was amazed by her, as you know, anyone who goes back and looks at what she was actually doing. May had this ability to prognosticate based on reading newspapers. She could tell you what was going to happen. A year before Jonestown happened, like exactly a year, she did a show where she said, you know, I think what's going on is they're training assassins at this place in Jonestown. This is before it's on anybody's radar. Like, nobody is tracking Jim Jones. And she sees what's happening right away. She does this over and over and over again. So the fact that Krasner took her seriously, and then I had written this review, and so he got in contact with me, and so he asked me to do a review for, he had a book coming out called Patty Hearst and the Twinkie Murders, and so I did a review of that for him, and he was happy with that. And so after that, we would correspond from time to time. He would send me things, I would send him things. And actually, for the last year or so, I've been writing articles for a magazine called Garrison, that S.T. Patrick is the publisher of, and it's his baby. And because he wanted to pay tribute to the great sort of radical magazines of the past, like Steam Shovel Press and, you know, Paranoia Magazine and, you know, and of course the Realist and Rampart. He wanted to get works written by people that were associated. So, for example, Ken Thomas wrote something for the first for Deep Truth Journal, which was what Garrison emerged from. Ken Thomas of Steam Shovel Press. And then he said, "Well, can you get Paul to do this thing?" So I contacted him. He couldn't do it back in July, and then last December he said, "Okay, you know, I'm working on my novel." But I can do this thing. But I, unbeknownst to me, I guess he was still pretty sick last December. So he never did respond to ST, and I would send him a message and say, okay, you know. But I guess, you know, I don't know, but I assume that he was pretty sick. And so unfortunately, he never did write that thing. So now instead I'm writing about him for the next issue.
Well, you know, I want to back up just a second, because a lot of what we talked about with regards to the sort of pranks and you know, what the Realists wrote about, the sort of satire, I think something that people often forget about the 1960s is that, you know, people call it the Summer of Love. But in a lot of ways, it was the summer of rage. I mean, you had the assassinations happening. By the tail end of it, you have the Manson murders. You know, there's all kinds of things going on. Even someone like a politician like Barry Goldwater. You know, when I read about Hunter S. Thompson's account of seeing the Goldwater supporters at the Republican National Convention, and they're, you know, Thompson's describing them as like shaking and cheering. It's almost like they're having like an orgy over this Goldwater guy talking to them. It's very reminiscent to what we see with Trump. The crimes of J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI. People think that what we're experiencing now with Trump is, you know, a completely new phenomenon. And in some ways, it may be. But the 60s wasn't exactly the easiest time either.
No, and no time has been. You know, if you were, if you are a part of a minority class or a class that does not have specific access to the what we'll call the good things of life, life has never been great for you. And that percentage of the population that responded to Goldwater, that responds to Trump now, I think that's always been the same. I mean, there's always been America firsters. You know, this, that's absolutely true. And I mean, the thing about, because there's so many complexities that go on with, the various presidents, but you do see a consistent foreign policy go through the presidents, particularly since the assassination of Kennedy. And a lot of what goes on between the difference between Trump and Obama is that Obama is able to do these things, and he's very likable. He has a high Q rating. You know, he's the, you know, he's a great speaker. Whereas Trump is just this, you know, this crude character. And I think that that lends itself to a certain political instability in our own country. In other words, that that as long as we have Barack Obama in charge, we can do all kinds of horrible things. You know, if Latin American countries and all, you know, all over the place. Because you have this kind of this person that looks good at the table, whereas with Trump, it's like, you know, and I understand why the liberals can't stand him. I mean, I can't stand him either. But what you're reacting to is like this you're having this disgust reaction to this terrible human being who is doing a lot of the same things that every other president has done, unfortunately.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, maybe a lot of it, I think, has to do with just the rhetoric involved. I mean, we hear a lot now with Trump. Trump talks about how he wants anti-fascists to be considered terrorists. He calls people like AOC and Ilhan Omar, you know, the squad, as some people are calling them. He calls them, oh, commies, and they should go back to where they came from. I mean, it's not that much different from the witch hunts that we saw under J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover, there's an FBI file on Tiny Tim, the guy who's saying tiptoes through the tulips, accusing him of being a communist subversive. I mean, the witch hunts never ended, folks.
Yeah. No, and we've had this sort of specter all along, like you mentioned with Hoover. You know, that's – go back and look at the history. And what I would say also – especially if you have to young people, one book that is completely invaluable to pick up, it's by William Bloom. It's called Killing Hope. And the thing that's great about it is what William does is he goes through all of the countries that we've invaded past World War II and goes into just a little section about what the reasons were. And I will tell you that if you look at what the military is doing during the entire period, is we are invading countries who have some sort of leftist ideology, or they're and when I say leftist ideology, I mean like they have a minimum wage. You know, they're not completely subversive dedicated to corporate profits. Or what the United States wants in a particular country. I mean, you go to Guatemala, you go to Venezuela. The ones that get in trouble are the ones that start doing even vaguely socialist things like building schools.
Right. The really far left actually refers to, you know, stuff like what happened in Venezuela as the pink wave. They don't view it as being radical enough.
No, it's not. And it's, you know, and you can see that they've been moving that to the right. Constantly, and the media does it all the time too. So where I see these people talking about, well, you know, we need to have somebody other than Trump, but not these radical leftists like Bernie Sanders. Like Bernie Sanders is not a radical leftist.
Bernie Sanders would have been considered a centrist.
Eisenhower.
Oh yeah, yeah. He would have been considered a centrist even in the 70s. You know, we have this move after the Reagan-Thatcher two-punch in the U.S. and Britain where everything just moves completely to the right and people don't even know it.
Yes. Yeah. And so you've been living under it now since the 80s. And so folks who weren't born before then or haven't, you know, done much work in history think that this is normal. And that's the whole point, is that you can normalize this over time. And so everybody moves that right-left side to the point where you don't even understand that you could go further left than this, that this is not, you know, we don't have to stop at Noam Chomsky. You know, we can get a hell of a lot more left than that. And because of that, it's warped everybody's view of everything. There was actually, it was kind of interesting. I saw, I think his name is Nail Hassan. He has a show on Netflix. And I caught this, he did this piece about video games. And I thought it was actually pretty good, because what he was trying, I mean, a show like that has its limitations, but he was trying to point to the fact that in order for people to play video games, it requires slave labor, effectively, from all of these different game companies who work people 80 hours a week. They don't get paid overtime, and they then get fired once the game comes out, and then they just hire a bunch more people and do the exact same thing. And so trying to organize in some sort of classic labor fashion would be a great idea for these folks who work for game companies. I mean, that's great. I mean, we could go a lot further, but, you know, that's a reasonable start.
Well, you know, I was going to add, speaking of the sort of powers that be, of the time period in the 60s and 70s, you know, Krasner would pretty directly confront these people. I mean, once published a red, white, and blue poster, and it just said, fuck communism.
Fuck communism, yep.
And he put an issue of The Realist with it, and he sent it to J. Edgar Hoover. And he said, I hope you get a chuckle out of the enclosed patriotic poster.
Yeah, no, that kind of stuff is awesome. I mean, I love that. There is, you can find also on YouTube, I don't know if it's still there, but he was on some kind of like, it looks like an ABC like morning show or something, where he's being interviewed by this guy, and the guy is hilarious. He is completely disgusted. He's appalled by Paul Krasner's existence.
Oh, is that the Joe Pine show?
That sounds right. I think
he was like the first combat television guy. He was like a precursor to Morton Downey Jr. Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah. I've seen that clip.
Oh, it's hysterical, you know. And you know, Krasner's the whole time. He's like, you know, well, this. Let me tell you what I'm doing. And and it's such a, you know, it was funny because I was watching that, and that clip looks like to me, every person that gets mad about somebody else's free speech. They sound like that, which will include a lot of leftists these days, unfortunately, or people who are alleged leftists who are trying to cancel each other all the time. But that clip should be like, everybody should see, everybody in the whole world should watch that clip because it's so good.
Well, I mean, with the fuck communism poster, I always liked that in particular because, you know, he's sending it to all these conservatives.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And they're the same. They hate communism. So they agree with the fuck communism part.
Yes.
They just don't want you to use the word fuck because they're so socially conservative. So it just like that probably made J. Edgar's head explode.
Yeah. No, it's such a great way to piss them off while seemingly agreeing with them. I mean, that's always that's a good tactic in general. He has there was something actually I was gonna read if I get the chance, if I can just find it again. I was pulling out all my Paul Krasner books. So kind of like Hunter S. Thompson, Krasner had because The Realist was essentially a satirical magazine, he wrote things sometimes, and I don't know if they're true or not. And there was one that I asked him about, and he didn't answer. But when Jonestown happened, a few days later, I think 9 days later, George Moscone and Harvey Milk were both shot to death in San Francisco. And I've written about this in a separate zine because Milk and Moscone both had links to Jonestown. And Krasner writes in one of his books that that they were cremated and they were put in the ocean with purple Kool-Aid. And I don't think that's true, but honestly, I don't really know. It's exactly the kind of detail that Krasner would make up.
Mm-hmm. Just like Hunter S. Thompson with the whole Ibogaine thing. Yeah,
exactly. And they were both aligned in that regard. I mean, there was the kind of the beginnings of journalism as fiction or fiction as journalism, inserting yourself into the story kind of. I think they were obviously hanging around at the same time, and this was a very literary circle in general. You've got all these people in it, and I wrote a play about a whole separate issue about this thing, but Ginsberg and Kerouac and all those guys, because they had tendrils everywhere, and that's also another thing that's sort of different from the 60s. I feel like if you were a young leftist, who would you look up to in this era? I mean, who would excite you now?
I think young leftists, they look for a lot of the YouTube stars. There's some people I like. I'm a big fan of ContraPoints. I think she does some good stuff. She's pretty humorous as well. But if you're not into the whole YouTube thing, or if you're not plugged into the internet, you don't necessarily come across these people. Maybe that's the new underground, though. Maybe the new underground is people making their own content through podcasts, videos on YouTube, etc.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly seems to be. I do question if that can really work, because I think all the stuff that Gerrymander and Neil Postman said about visual culture still holds. I mean, your brain still goes into a passive state when you're watching something on television rather than reading, and there's certainly less engagement. So I don't know if that is that a model that can really work. Is anybody doing work on this, come to think of it?
You know, I wish more people did, because I think Postman's whole amusing ourselves to death is something that people should think about a little bit more.
Well, yeah, especially in our, you know, it's like it's multiplied all over the place with this current culture. You know, it's in some fashion. I mean, sometimes I think it's great, sometimes I think it's a disaster, but I'm also getting to be an old guy. So you gotta take all my opinions with a grain of salt, because I'm 47 now. So,
well, I think there's some truth to what you're saying, though, too. I mean, even looking at Twitter, you know, you have lefty kids fighting the alt-right kids on Twitter, and it's all about like scoring a point over your opponent. And I think to myself, like, it was so much more dangerous when guys like Abby Hoffman and Paul Krasner with the Yippies were, you know, starting something like the White Panther Party and teaming up with the Black Panthers. The White Panthers were actually, they weren't like what you would think. You know, they're not some white nationalist group, right? They were supporting the Black Panthers. And the FBI tried to create division between them, between the Black Panthers and the White Panthers, according to Paul Krasner. So it was very dangerous.
Yeah, it's part of COINTELPRO. It was that whole, and that was, I mean, and I also, I mean, I'm slightly nostalgic for some of this stuff. It was a great lecture I was listening to by this anarchist, and he's lecturing to a group of college students, and he says, first of all, he says, the bravest people that I knew were the people who joined the military during the Vietnam War, so they could try to organize within the military, except for the people who joined the police force to try and organize within the police force against the same forces. And that's so absolutely true, and so absolutely not what a bunch of college students want to hear.
Well, it's so weird, because I often wonder why there's not more on the left who do that. There's one podcast I know of sort of lefty ex-military guys. It's called, I think it's called Eyes Left. They're interested in that, but it just seems like it's very odd, because the right in this country, especially the far right, they understand that if they can infiltrate, you know, institutions like the FBI, the military, the police, that's power. The left has sort of lost sight of that in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's probably it's an inevitable situation in some fashion, because the nature of leftist politics, and I include myself in this, it does tend to be a little bit ivory tower. I mean, I am really interested in theory, in addition to everything else. And I can easily get lost in that. And it's something that actually JJ, John Judge, used to tell me, we're doing something here. So, you know, we'd be at a protest or something, and I'm helping and doing something or other, but I would get sidetracked, you know, talking to somebody or arguing with somebody. And it's very easy to do that, because we have that capacity. And you probably know this, that if you are joining the police force, they give you an IQ test, but not because you can score too low, but because you can score too high. They do not want anybody with, you know, higher than average IQ joining the police force, because they become susceptible to what I would say are, you know, more of a theoretical leaning to things. And if you start to understand other human beings at an empathic level, I don't think you can function anymore in your capacity as a police officer.
Well, you know, I think it also, another thing this ties into is, you know, I think one of the greatest things that Paul Krassner was able to do was he was able to, you know, just mock these people. I mean, Hunter S. Thompson, you got the righteous anger with Hunter, you know, where he would be calling people greed heads and whatnot. And I love that about Hunter S. Thompson. But Paul Krassner just knew how to just mock these people with wit. I remember I have one of his books. It's Impolite Interviews. And it's interviews that Paul Krassner did for The Realist. And he would interview everyone, Timothy Leary and all kinds of figures. Well, one of the interviews in that book is George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the Nazi party. And Krassner just runs circles around him. He just makes Rockwell look like the fool that Rockwell is, rather than empowering Rockwell as a boogeyman or as someone to be afraid of. Krassner's just like, this guy's a dork.
Yep. And it used to be you could work with that. Trump has not been very susceptible to that, because, exposing him as an idiot seems to galvanize his followers. They seem to like his sort of idiot blunderings. Krassner was great at that. And it's funny, you know, thing about Lincoln Rockwell and the strange bedfellows of the 60s. Before Malcolm X went to Mecca, Malcolm X met with Lincoln Rockwell because they had the same goal.
Well, it's much like how Louis Farrakhan would meet with, white supremacists like Willis Carto of American Free Press. They used to meet at conferences together, because black separatism and white separatism ultimately have the same goals.
Exactly. The idea was you were going to go back to Africa, which just goes back to the Black Star Line and that whole thing. But you're absolutely right. And in fact, Farrakhan stayed true to the American Muslim movement in that regard, and Malcolm didn't. When Malcolm went to Mecca, he changed everything, and then, of course, he got killed. And in fact, Farrakhan was one of those people who incited it, because he helped give out flyers, that called for Malcolm X's execution.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, let me find that. I was trying to find the there was a passage that I thought was really interesting. I was going to try to read. Well, there's one thing I was going to say. He did it was a haiku that Krassner did after talking with Terrence McKenna. And the haiku goes like this: aspirins and Prozac, Tums, Nytol, Pepto-Bismol. Just say no to drugs. And that's exactly right. Because he would tell you to take LSD before you took Pepto-Bismol, and there's something to that.
Well, the other thing is that he wasn't just involved with people that were known just for politics either. I mean, he was praised by Kurt Vonnegut. And of course, there's also the famous story. People can look this up. I don't know if we can get too much into it because no one can tell the story like Paul does. But he was on the set of this movie called Skidoo. And he was taking acid with Groucho Marx on the set of that movie because I guess Groucho Marx wanted to do research into LSD before he did the movie, since the movie is like an acid trip type storyline.
Yeah, it's a pretty chaotic, absurd movie, and that was one of his things. He took LSD with Groucho Marx and Squeaky Fromm.
Oh, the Manson family.
Yeah, he did. so it's like he was involved in everything. Like he was connected to everything, and that's what it was so amazing about the guy. This was also, by the way, and very interesting. He was a child prodigy on the violin, so he was playing it when he was like 6 years old, playing concerts. Of course, he gave that all up to be a professional scatologist, but it's still you know, it gives you an idea of the capacity of the man.
And also, even though he did the realist, he wasn't like some, you know, trust fund kid or anything like that. As far as I understand it, he struggled as a journalist a lot of times.
Yes, he did. He did. Until the realist really took off. Yeah, he was. Well, I mean, and it was, again, coming from the times, it wasn't he wasn't being funded by Henry Luce. You know, he was having to do things on his own and create the counterculture. That's what ultimately you come to see is that, you know, Lenny Bruce is kind of a harbinger, but also a creator. And Krasner was in that same boat of the people who were creating what was going to become the dominant culture for a little while.
Well, I was going to say, you know, he personally knew Lenny. I mean, he considered he was a prodigy of Lenny Bruce. He even edited Bruce's biography, How to Talk Dirty and Influence People. So there's a close connection there. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. And he was working on, when he died, he was working on a novel. It was going to be his long-awaited novel, at least by himself. And it was about a Lenny Bruce-type character in the modern times. So I don't know how far he got through the novel, but, you know, it might be very interesting to take a look at what exists.
Well, you know, there were maybe two more things I wanted to mention because it's two things that I sort of remember him for. And it's the first is this very controversial poster. Forewarning everyone, this is graphic. Can you tell my listeners a little bit about the Disneyland Memorial Orgy poster?
Probably you should just look at it, to be honest. You know, and actually it's funny. It links to something else, which is that, you probably know that copyright law, they've been filing these extensions for many years. And actually, I think Krasner was part of the reason for that. Because at a certain point, right, Mickey Mouse is going to go into the public domain. And so if you want to do a BDSM Mickey Mouse, you know, fucking a goat or whatever, you can, I mean, Krasner's already done it essentially, but you can do it, right? But Disney has, you know, every lawyer in the universe, and, you know, endless money. And so they've been extending copyright forever on all of these different characters. And I bet you anything that Krasner is the one who put them on the radar because of this highly, I don't know, what would you say, graphic picture?
it basically adultifies your favorite Disney characters. And it's funny to me because now that's almost like normalized. You know, there's a movie coming out now, The Banana Splits, which is based off of the famous, you know, kids psychedelic band. But it's a horror movie. It's going to be a slasher movie with the Banana Splits killing people. And I'm like, that's like something out of a Paul Krasner, you know, short story.
Yeah, and it probably also, and I don't know, but it probably influenced Ralph Bakshi's stuff too, because Ralph Bakshi's work in the 70s was kind of, and he had actually worked for Disney.
Fritz the Cat, right?
Fritz the Cat and Heavy Traffic, and Coonskin and Wizards. I mean, yeah, a bunch of all these films in the '70s were heavily, certainly influenced by everything that went on in the '60s, but I would imagine that he was a big realist fan too.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, people say, well, oh, that's horrible. How can you make, adult cartoons? But I mean, it's kind of, now it's passé, but I think it was an interesting way to push the envelope. Like, maybe you can do more with this medium than people ever expected. That's how it was back then.
Oh, completely. And there's a lot of, like, he got away with a lot of really funny stuff that you couldn't, it would be difficult to, like, if Bakshi were trying to do something and do what he did in those films in live action, they would probably be rated X. And in fact, Fritz the Kid was rated X, even though it was a cartoon. So, I mean, it enabled you to have that additional layer of distance where you can maybe show things that you would not be able to show in live action.
Well, you know, I guess the other thing was, you know, you mentioned that book, Patty Hearst and the Twinkie Murders. I guess that there's two sides to that, but I wanted to get your take on, you know, maybe what his view of the Patty Hearst incident was, and then we can get into the Twinkie murder.
Yeah, well, so we had this, you know, I'm on a number of different email groups, and one of them was sort of going back and forth as to whether Krasner was a quote-unquote conspiracy guy. I think there's no question that Krasner was a quote-unquote conspiracy guy. He wrote about these things in great detail, and he had kind of a I would compare him to sort of William S. Burroughs in his view of the world. So in Patty Hearst and the Twinkie Murders, he's writing about the 1974 kidnapping of William Randolph Hearst's daughter, and it was led by a guy named Donald DeFries. Donald DeFries was the head of the Symbionese Liberation Army, except that two things about Donald DeFries we need to know. One is that, like Charles Manson, he was at Vacaville in the '50s, which was an MK Ultra prison. Secondly, Donald DeFries had also been an informant, a police informant on black revolutionary groups. This is before he ever joined or created the SLA. And also, the one of the key things, and you know what, I'm just going to, let me pull out the book here, because there's a really key passage where he talks about some of the connections between the various things that he's talking about. So I'm going to just start off. It's about this. This is about a guy named Charles Bates. Now, Charles Bates was a he worked for the FBI. So it's just two paragraphs. So this is now quoting from Paul Krasner's book. In 1969, Charles Bates was a special agent at the Chicago office of the FBI when police killed Black Panthers Fred Hampton and Mark Clark while they were sleeping. Ex-FBI informant Marcia Fisher told the Chicago Daily News that the then chief of the FBI Chicago office, Marlon Johnson, personally asked her to slip a drug to Hampton. She had infiltrated the Black Panther Party at the FBI's request a month before. The drug was a tasteless, colorless liquid that would put him to sleep. She refused. Hampton was killed a week later. An autopsy showed a near fatal dose of psychobarbital in his system. Okay. In 1971, Bates was transferred to Washington, D.C. According to Watergate burglar James McCord's book, A Piece of Tape, on June 21st, 1972, 4 days after the break-in, White House attorney John Dean checked with acting FBI director as to who was in charge of handling the Watergate investigation. The answer? Charles Bates, the same FBI official who in 1974 would be in charge of handling the SLA investigation and the search for Patty Hearst. So very, very, very interesting. So just to summarize that very quickly, Charles Bates was a special agent when Fred Hampton was murdered, which I've written about at length in an essay called The Open Assassination of Fred Hampton. You can find that on the web. And he was also in charge of the Watergate investigation and the same investigation into the SLA and Patty Hearst. And I think, I don't know this to be true, but I believe that Krasner probably was put onto
the SLA thing, because Mae Brussel had pointed out that the entire Patty Hearst scenario had been written about in a pornographic novel 1 year before the whole incident happened. And it mirrored the details very, very closely.
Well, I think Krasner has said himself, he said in one of the interviews I was listening to before we recorded this, that he considers the Patty Hearst kidnapping a government operation. He just said it like pretty openly, you know, and the host was like, oh, okay. But, you know, he was straightforward with what he believed.
Yes, and absolutely. And he connects that, and then so it's in two parts. You know, the first part is Patty Hearst, and he goes into some of the weirdnesses that were involved in the murder of Harvey Milk and George Moscone that I was talking about earlier. He does not go into the same detail that John Judge went into in The Black Hole of Guyana, and I really expanded upon Mae Brussel and John Judge when I wrote my article on or my zine on them. On Guyana, which is a long story, but he does, as I say, point out that those murders are happening just a few days after the whole Jonestown thing goes on, and in the course of Dan White's defense, his lawyer argued that he was under the influence of sugar when he shot Harvey Milk and Moscone, and it was called the Twinkie defense. And as a result, White only got 7 years.
I've actually read that Krasner may have been the first one to like coin that phrase too. The Twinkie defense.
I think so. It's certainly in his book, and I don't remember if he actually says it, but I think you're right. So, and that became, and of course, and what's funny, the funny thing about, you know, historical memory is, like people like my dad or you know, people who lived during the time, they remember the Twinkie defense. They remember it's very memorable. And they remember, oh yeah, I remember that one guy. But they don't remember everything else. All the other like bizarre things that were going on with that case, because there are millions of them. And one of the things that I think that Krasner does, and I think that the satirical mode of the realist was really good for this, is it allowed him to kind of deconstruct these political and historical happenings under the cover of satire, because you could always say, oh, well, this is the most outrageous magazine in the world. You know, that gives you a certain amount of, you know, you can say certain truths maybe within this context. And that's basically what George Carlin did. George Carlin said he was, you know, that the realist changed his life. He said, oh, my God, I read this thing. I can I don't have to be like Bill Cosby. I can do what I want to do. I want to be a hippie. I want to grow my hair out, and I want to talk about hippie experiences.
I always liked that George Carlin bit where he's like, there's a big club and you're not in it. And it's funny because the audience he's speaking to is like laughing about it, but you almost get the impression he's talking about them.
No, there's no question. I mean, that was the great thing about Carlin and prior to some extent too, is that you would get these kind of huge social truths, but you know, you're laughing your ass off during it. I mean, that's the peak of that type of humor, in my view.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of comedians like that. I mean, back when Paul Krasner was doing The Realist, the big thing was they called it sick humor as a pejorative. It was guys like Mort Saul, Dick Gregory, and they had an interest in the Kennedy assassination. They were very political. I mean, Lenny Bruce, you know, before he died, he basically dedicated himself to speaking out against, you know, the cops and the violations against free speech that were happening. So it was a very political time in comedy.
And Mort Saul is still alive and, you know, still talks about, you know, the Kennedy assassination, you know, in private correspondence to folks. Dick Gregory was, you know, I could do a whole show on Dick Gregory too, which, and also, I got to spend a very enjoyable, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours with Greg when we shot an interview with him in D.C. And he's a force of nature, that guy. And he liked me because I could keep up with his stuff, because he was a guy who, you know, he was involved in everything besides running for president in 1968. You know, he knew everybody, and he had an interest and had, in fact, he carried a bag, and in this bag, it was filled with manila folders, and the manila folders were full of articles about everything, every political and historical atrocity under the sun. It's very exciting.
Well, you know, the other thing I was going to say about the realist, you were saying how you can speak certain truths through humor, but I think the other side of that is that when you really get down to the brass tacks of it, there is no way that you can't look at a lot of these things he's talking about and not laugh. I mean, the Twinkie defense, you have to laugh at that. You have to laugh at someone like J. Edgar Hoover, Mr. Conservative, Mr. Anti-Communist, who was known, you know, it was an open secret that he had many sexual indiscretions. You know, the filmmaker Larry Cohen, who recently passed away, even made a whole movie about it, The Secret Files of J. Edgar Hoover. That was more a dramatic take on it. But Krasner was willing to make fun of it, not because of the sexual indiscretions themselves, but because of the hypocrisy, you know? And I think Krasner did a brilliant job of just pointing out the absurdity of those in power.
Yeah, which has become, you know, it's a cliche now. Hoover was Hoover was the first hypocrite in that regard. But now I think it's assumed now that when we see rabidly right-wing politicians screaming about gays, that we just assume that he's, you know, working stuff out that he's not comfortable with. So it's you get a certain truth out of that as well.
Well, now you have a president who is bonking porn stars, and you have Christian evangelicals still supporting him in spite of it. So it's reached beyond absurdity.
It is, yes, it's beyond satire. It is, and I remember talking about that when he was first elected. It was like, how in the world, like, satire is dead. Where do we go from here?
Well, you know, I think too, something that gets missed when talking about Paul is, you know, he said once let me see if I can pull it up. Jonah Raskin interviewed him a number of times, and he collected these interviews in a booklet called Paul Krasner Speaks, From Lenny Bruce and Obama to Hebdo. And one of the lines that Krasner had was, "My slogan for the realist used to be, irreverence is our only sacred cow."
Yeah.
But I've had second thoughts. Irreverence has become an industry and can become irreverence for its own sake. Mean-spirited stereotypes in the guise of satire. You know, so I think sometimes people forget Paul wasn't just doing irreverence to be irreverent. Like, there was a meaning to it, and I don't think he would like the type of mean-spirited humor that just floods the internet today and the sort of mass media culture. He would say, well, what's the point of it?
Yes. No, and that's actually what I was talking about when I first I didn't do a very good job of articulating it, but when I was first talking about the fact that, you know, the Stephen Colbert type show that has, you know, evolved or devolved from the type of thing that Krasner was doing. It's exactly that. It's irreverence and inaction. You know, so you laugh at it, you think it's funny, but you don't do anything, you know, which is not what Krasner was about.
Well, I mean, now, too, we have all these right wingers that say, you know, we're the irreverent ones. I know that geek, Paul Joseph Watson from InfoWars, said that conservatism is the new counterculture. I think Paul Krasner would puke at that because, you know, it's just mean-spirited. Like, why would I want to make fun of someone for their sexuality or if they're trans? Like, you're just picking on people that are already marginalized. That's not revolutionary. It's not even irreverent. It's just punching downward.
It's punching downward, right? And I mean, by its very nature, being rabidly right wing means that you lack wit. so that's why there are no great right wing comedians.
That's, you know, I've never thought about it, but that is very true.
Yeah, what are you gonna do?
Well, I don't know. What do you sort of want to wrap up on in regards to Paul Krasner, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about some of your upcoming work.
Sure. Well, I mean, I just wanted to, the first thing I really wanted to do when you asked me about this is to get across that I was an extremely minor figure with regard to Paul Krasner. You know, he was, I met him the last 5 years of his life. You know, he liked something that I wrote. We sent some stuff to each other. And he was very kind and accommodating all the time. Like, you know, he didn't need to. He's 82 years old. You know, what the hell does he need me for? He doesn't.
And there's another aspect to that. Not only was he 82 years old when you started corresponding with him, but one thing we didn't mention in regard to the Twinkie defense and the whole Harvey Milk assassination is that Paul Krasner actually had a pretty bad run-in with the cops during or after that trial. There was a riot. And he was beaten by the cops. And
yes.
I believe that he couldn't afford health insurance, so he thought it would just... He was still young enough, and he thought it would heal. But he didn't heal up from that completely, so he was in a lot of pain, as I understand it.
Yes, yes. I think we had one sort of oblique reference to that in the correspondence that we gave, that we had, but he never really got into detail of that with me. You're right. You're right. He had to, he suffered from that beating the rest of his life. Well, speaking of the prices that one has to pay when you're doing this stuff. But I did want to get across that Paul was, you know, he's very kind. He, you know, all of his satire, if you look at it now, I mean, some of it may be slightly passe because we've already become accustomed to the style. But it was radically offensive. And even now, I mean, if you wrote an article about Lyndon Johnson fucking Kennedy's neck wound in the morgue, that's pretty transgressive, I would say. I think a lot of people would be offended by that.
Well, I think LBJ deserves it. I mean, regardless of what you think of LBJ politically, I mean, the man was a sex fiend asshole. He treated women horribly.
Well, he treated everybody horribly. And you know, it's funny about that. I mean, and to get into more of that image, I mean, the fact of the matter is that Lyndon Johnson had a habit of pulling his dick out with women privately and with men publicly. Like, he used to do that to a Secret Service. He peed on the Secret Service guys. He told a group of reporters, you know, Vietnam's about my balls, you know, and he took out his, you know, this was a very crude guy. So that illustration, although it's crude, is not that far off from the truth.
Well, I mean, there's stories of him just flopping his dick out on the White House desk. I mean, this was a very crude guy. He probably, you know, Krasner wasn't off the mark in a lot of ways.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, and again, it's in real time. That's what the other thing about this is that I know how hard it is to read the political and historical tea leaves, you know, while things are happening. The fact that Paul Krasner and Mae Brussel were able to do this while things were going on is what's really astonishing to me. Their work is really, really incisive and useful, and a lot more useful than a lot of the standard histories of the period.
Well, you know, it just came to mind. I don't know if you came across this in your correspondence with him, or maybe you could speculate a little. He slowed down a lot in later years. Like I said, he had pain issues, but he was always kind to people. I'm just curious, what do you think he would think of the current political moment, the Trump junta, as I call it?
Well, I mean, he did talk about it. It was more, this is why I wonder about the Lenny Bruce thing, because I'm really curious about. Because I assume that the only reason that you would write a novel about a Lenny Bruce figure now is to comment on precisely that. So I feel like there's probably pages in there that will say exactly what he thought. You know, so I don't know if that exists or if that's going to come out at some point. I imagine, you know, whoever's in charge of his estate. But I'm really, really interested in that.
Well, I think we can hope, and I think we can always look back at the legacy of Paul Krasner and just see someone who we can follow in the footsteps of. We can take a lot of lessons from Paul Krasner, not only his humor, but his astute mind in looking at history and current events.
Yes, and you don't have to, and like a lot of these, one thing that does bother me is that the notion that you have to agree with every single idea that somebody else has in order to learn from them or you know, have them in your pantheon, you know. That part is far less important than paying attention to the approach and the wit and the kind of the tactics and a lot of the work. Whether or not you specifically agree with Paul Krasner on one point or another is, you know, it's trivial.
I hope you enjoyed that tribute to Paul Krasner, Yippie activist and investigative satirist. Krasner's infamous zine, The Realist, is fully archived online, free of charge, and that will be, of course, linked in the episode synopsis for those of you looking to explore more of Paul's work. Joseph and I also did a little bit of a post-game chit-chat regarding his work on conspiracy theories that will be posted shortly on the Parallax Views Patreon page. In any case, I hope you enjoyed this edition of Parallax Views. Remember, think for yourself and question authority. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.